difficult to answer. Robert Carter, London.
On Wednesday in the Italian capital, humanitarian activists gathered outside the Italian parliament to stage a protest against an anti-migration deal between Rome and Tripoli. The protest, dubbed a blindfold to avoid seeing the truth, was called by a number of NGOs ahead of a crucial parliamentary vote on the renewal of the accord. Protesters were saying the deal has been causing suffering to tens of thousands of refugees since its signing in 2017.
Under the deal, Italy helps Libyan maritime authorities to stop boats at sea and return the illegal migrants to detention centers in Libya. At least 50,000 people, including thousands of children, have been returned to the northern African country so far. However, the condition in Libya is a matter of concern as they face detention and serious abuse, including rape and torture.
I think it's not a problem, unfortunately, only of the Italian government and the country. It's a European problem, and the European policies, basically, Europe endorses the Italian initiative.
During the protest, activists read messages of desperation sent by the refugees trapped in war-ravaged Libya. Some refugees have unsuccessfully attempted to cross the Mediterranean up to 3-4 times.
Facciamo finta di non vedere cosa succede.
We keep turning a blind eye to what is happening in Libya. The decision to renew the deal is a shameful display of how far EU governments are prepared to go to keep refugees and migrants from Europe's shores.
C'è una parte della politica italiana.
Here in Italy, some politicians deal with the migrants as if they were enemies at the gates, creating fear among Italians. The other politicians make sure not to create too much discomfort to their electorate.
Some lawmakers who attended the protest also said that an Italian Navy ship docked in Tripoli has even directly coordinated the intercepting activities carried out on the refugee boats by the Libyan Coast Guard. Later on Wednesday, Foreign Minister Luigi Di Maio told the House that Italy will no more fund the Libyan Coast Guard to encourage a management of migrant flows that is more respectful of international norms by Tripoli. Max Civili, Rome.
Bagrame Air Base in northern Parwan province was known as the main U.S. military headquarters in Afghanistan over the past 20 years. This is why experts have blamed the U.S. for wasting international aids to Afghanistan by building America's largest military base in the country.
The U.S. has built Bagram military base by wasting international aids that were earmarked for modernization of the Afghan National Army and the country's development. The airbase is now vacated without U.S. achieving its goals.
As this army general says, the U.S. forces informed Afghans of their pullout earlier but set no exact time for their departure.
Early morning, once we received some rumors that U.S. Army left the Bagram, we increased our intelligence and our reports that we got that yes, they left the Bagram, and after that we entered to the base and took the old tower and secure inside of the Bagram as well.
After talking to the ANA commander, we headed to former symbol of U.S. military power in Afghanistan, Bagram Air Base. A parking lot is located at one of the four entrances of the air base. The U.S. forces have left many of these vehicles behind. Afghan forces say U.S. forces have disabled the electronic systems of these military vehicles instead of disabling the war machine of Taliban.
Now, Afghan officials said they are going to fix such military vehicles to use them in fighting against terrorism across Afghanistan.
After crossing the entrance gate, we faced a real American town where U.S. forces have spent long nights and days despite failing to achieve their major stated goal that was uprooting terrorism here. Now, Afghans are in charge of such mission.
Having control over Bagram helps Afghan forces to effectively manage and launch counter-terrorism operations against terrorist groups.
It seems that the U.S. forces had access to high technology, emergency protection measures and welfare amenities in different parts of this airfield to reduce the level of harm, particularly the psychological harm that was coming from the Afghan war to US forces. For instance, this gas station had been supplying fuel to hundreds of big generators across the air base. Afghan forces have collected these GEM tools from different GEMs located in Bagram, saying the US forces had access to not only GEMs, but also to cinema and restaurants as well. Despite being equipped with a modern air defense system protecting Bagram Air Base during US military presence here, emergency exit ways like this one served as a central part of the base. Meanwhile, there have been hundreds of hideouts like this one built by American troops to protect them against possible Taliban rocket attacks. Visiting residential buildings of the US forces in Bagram is also a need. But the bitter fact is that Afghan forces even do not have access to the codes of some doors of the residential buildings in Bagram. So they have no way but to use things to keep the doors open. The presence of meal packages, air conditioner systems, refrigerators, microwaves, internet access and TVs that have been left in residential areas by the US forces once again proves that how big difference was and is between a foreign military soldier and an Afghan soldier. There are also many warehouses like this food warehouse in Bagram. Bagram Hospital is the other destination for us. The modern hospital is dark now and we need to use either torch or our camera light to see what is inside. The flame of Washington's longest war in Afghanistan hospitalized thousands of US soldiers in rooms like this one. These beds, medicines and medical equipment could save the lives of thousands of wounded US troops. But hundreds of them lost their lives here in Bagram Hospital and never returned back to the US due to severe injuries. And now, with rising insecurity in Afghanistan, only time will tell whether or not the Afghan government can make this strategic air base operational due to shortage of financial resources. Syed Amin Alami, Bagram Air Base in Northern Parwan Province.
The Iranian government has expressed anger over the participation of Italian politician Franco Frattini to a hybrid virtual and face-to-face meeting hosted by terror organization MKO in Albania last weekend. MKO is seen by geopolitical experts as a dangerous sectarian group that was on the list of terrorist organizations of the EU and the US for several years. Despite that, a number of international figures, including former US Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and former Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper, have given their full support for this group.
The truth is that the MKO has always been instrumental to the geopolitical strategies of Western countries. It's been designated as a terrorist organization for many years, and its delisting was very much linked to a plan to increase pressure on Tehran. This only shows the double standards of the West when it comes to terrorist groups. MKO's collusion with the US and the Israeli intelligence is a known fact.
Frattini is a former European Commissioner and Foreign Minister under two Berlusconi governments between 2002 and 2011. As the head of Italy's foreign affairs, in 2003 he sent an Italian military and police contingent to Iraq and Afghanistan in support of the US hegemonic influence in the Middle East. Frattini currently holds the post of director of the prestigious Italian Society for International Organization, a non-profit body operating under the supervision of the Italian Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Contacted by Press TV, the former Italian minister has declined to comment on its appearance at the MKO event held in Albania.
Frattini's participation in the MKO's annual conference comes as no surprise. Some governments interacting with terrorist organizations to avoid boots-on-the-ground combat operation need well-known political figures who support them to validate their illegal actions.
Iran has summoned the ambassador of Slovenia to Tehran to voice protest at the Slovenian Prime Minister Janez Janša's participation in the anti-Iran virtual gathering organized by the MKO. In an official letter of protest, Tehran has called the Slovenian Prime Minister's move unacceptable and undiplomatic.
Ties between Italy and Iran have been forever connoted by consistent mutual empathy, to the point that not even the US unilaterally imposed sanctions completely stopped their relations. Rome has long been Tehran's main trade partner, and hundreds of Italian companies are looking forward to fully resuming trade with Iran. Max Civili, Rome.
A Yemeni rights advocacy group called the Eye of Humanity Center for Rights and Development has released a new report that highlights the destruction of Yemen's infrastructure in over 6 years of war by Saudi Arabia and some of its regional allies.
The bombardment of civilian areas by the Saudi-led coalition's warplanes and artillery units have turned more than 500,000 homes into ruin. The attacks have also targeted 15 airports across Yemen, turning them non-operational. The seaports in the impoverished country, which are the only lifeline for people, have not been spared either. 16 Yemeni ports have been damaged in the coalition airstrikes. The ongoing Saudi-led military campaign has also resulted in the total or partial destruction of 391 hospitals or health facilities.
An important part of the report also highlights the number of victims of the Saudi-led war. The advocacy group says more than 43,000 Yemenis have been either killed or injured in the conflict.
17,176 people have been killed in Saudi-led attacks on Yemen. These include more than 3,800 children and 2,400 women. 26,700 people have also been wounded. These include over 4,200 children and 2,800 women.
Children have sustained a significant number of casualties in Saudi-led attacks. Yet the United Nations last month, in a controversial move, added Yemen's Ansarullah movement to its 2021 list of violators of children's rights. That sparked condemnations with Yemen's political leadership, saying that such a move by the world body is detached from realities on the ground and is not based on independent reports. Last year, the UN removed the Saudi-led coalition from the list of shame, an annual blacklist of parties violating children's rights. That despite the UN's own investigators found the coalition of killing or injuring hundreds of children in its relentless bombing campaign on the impoverished nation. Saudi Arabia was first included on the blacklist in 2016, but the decision was reversed shortly after the kingdom threatened to cut off funding to UN programs. The UN this year excluded Saudi Arabia from the list not to antagonize the kingdom again. Riyadh, along with some of its allies and backed by the West, has been bombing Yemen since 2015. It has also imposed an all-out blockade on the country. These have resulted in the world's biggest humanitarian crisis in Yemen, where 2 in 3 people, according to the UN, need help to survive, and children are dying from entirely preventable causes in their thousands. According to Yemen's health ministry, at least one child dies every 5 minutes as a result of Saudi siege or attacks. The extent of casualties and damage reveals the brutality of the Saudi-led coalition toward Yemen. Still, the West and the UN continue to show their double standard when it comes to Yemen and embolden Saudi Arabia to continue committing crimes. It seems what matters the most is Saudi petrodollars, not the loss of innocent human lives.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans, and I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps, and seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
The Spotlight.
Now, for the first time in decades, South Africa is calling up thousands of reservists to tackle a wave of looting and violence. Food, fuel, and medicine chains have been targeted. More than 110 people have been killed and thousands more arrested. Now, all this since former President Jacob Zuma started a 15-month jail term last week. Now, what has turned rallies into violent encounters and lootings in a matter of a week? And that's what we'll put on the spotlight.
South Africa has been in utter chaos since last Thursday, a day after former President Jacob Zuma handed himself into authorities to serve a 15-month jail term. Zuma was convicted of contempt of court after he defied an order to testify before a judicial commission probing allegations of fraud during his years in office. The former leader's imprisonment sparked protests across much of South Africa. The unrest soon escalated into mayhem. In the past 7 days, more than 800 retail shops and over 200 shopping malls have been looted. Government estimates suggest hundreds of millions of dollars of goods have been purloined or destroyed. That has sparked fears of a looming humanitarian crisis, with authorities warning that parts of South Africa may soon be running short of basic provisions. Analysts believe this could be a further blow to the nation's economy, already reeling from the coronavirus pandemic.
What could come out of this, of course, would be even further economic crises in South Africa. Amid this COVID-19 third wave, which has impacted South Africa more than any other country on the African continent.
The South African army has already deployed thousands of troops to help overstretched police restore order. That proving insufficient, the government has called another 25,000 army reserve troops to tackle the emergency. In addition, people in areas worst hit by the violence have taken up arms and formed vigilante groups to protect their neighborhoods. South Africa is experiencing one of its worst crises since the end of apartheid regime in early 1990s. With the former president in prison, high unemployment, and much of the country plagued by crime, it is hard to imagine an easy path back to normalcy.
Hello, welcome to the Spotlight with me, Behrouz Najafi. Now, let's see who's joining us in this edition. Full professor of political science and deputy dean of research with the University of Western Cape, author of The Politics and Higher Education in East Africa from the 1920s to 1970s, Becky Ngomezulo in Cape Town. Okay, we'll also have the endowed chair of the History and African American Studies, author of The White Supremacy Confronted, Gerald Horn in Houston. Now, Becky, a call-up on this scale has never happened since the end of the apartheid regime in 1994. What's been behind such an unprecedented mayhem and violence in South Africa?
Thank you very much, and good evening to our listeners. Basically, it's a combination of factors. Some of the issues have been there since 1994. When we got our freedom or our democracy in 1994, there were certain things that were not done, and there are a number of promises that were made, but which were never fulfilled. And these things have been piling up. All they needed was just a spark to ignite and then bring the country to where it is right now. So the reason why we have so many soldiers being dispatched to try and contain the situation is because of a number of mistakes that have happened, starting with the manner in which the case of former President Zuma was handled, and then, of course, starting with the Zondo Commission on the allegations of state capture. So there have been a number of mistakes from all ends. And then when those mistakes were not corrected on time, the situation deteriorated and got out of hand. And government was unable to contain the situation using the police, as is usually the case. Hence then the reason to bring in the army to try and assist the police force. This is basically unprecedented in the post-apartheid era. And it's a shame to the country. Shame to the continent.
Okay, Gerald, businesses in South Africa are mainly owned by whites, as you know, and they make up about 9% of the working population there. Now, most of the country's arable land remains are also owned by white farmers. The apartheid is gone, but South Africa still has one of the highest inequality rates. What's your take on that?
Well, I think if you look at what happened in neighboring Zimbabwe when there was an attempt to redress economic inequality that's grounded in racism, you saw that seizing the land of the so-called white minority caused sanctions to be imposed upon the Zimbabwean regime, and to an extent, those sanctions are still there. That was the signal to the incoming African National Congress government in 1994 that it should tread carefully. Therefore, the finger of accusation should be pointed at the sanctions imposing government, speaking of London and Washington in the first place. And that brings me to the other issue. When the African National Congress government came to power in 1994, one of its major allies, speaking of the Soviet Union, had just collapsed. That helped to empower the major ally of the white minority, speaking of the United States of America, and that also handicapped the ability of the incoming ANC government to address these questions of equality and inequality. And I would add another factor, and that is the maladministration of Jacob Zuma now sitting in prison. In retrospect, it was probably a mistake when the African National Congress government recalled his predecessor, speaking of Thabo Mbeki, who was the successor as president of Nelson Mandela. They recalled Mbeki put Zuma in that position. There were many reasons for that, but in any case, in retrospect, that was a major blunder, because now Zuma and his comrades and cronies charged with looting the treasury of billions and billions of dollars that could have been used to redress inequality, could have been used to confront this COVID crisis that is now harming South Africa more than any other country on the African continent. And therefore, Mr. Zuma personally bears a good deal of responsibility for this crisis, as does the members of the African National Congress who helped to put him in office in the first place.
Okay. Now, Becky, as you know, the unemployment rate is pretty high in South Africa, especially among the youth. It's reached a record level of nearly 33% in the first quarter of 2021. So tell us how seriously this unemployment thing could affect the tide of dissatisfaction and all this objection.
Yes, indeed, it is a critical factor. And in fact, what started off as a group of people who were supporting the former President Zuma, as I said earlier on, it triggered the problems that were already underlying there, and we're just waiting for a trigger to spike all of these things that have happened. If you look at the population of South Africa and the population of the African continent for that matter, it is predominantly young. So then if you have a number of graduates who leave universities and colleges and then join the public with the hope of bettering their lives, and only to find themselves adding numbers to the unemployment rate, then of course it's a cause for concern.
Okay, looks like we've had some technical problem. Let's turn to Houston. Gerald, protests into the jailing of Zuma turned into looting and vandalism, as you know. Is this the disgruntled people? Who is leading this?
Well, that is a major question. The government has suggested that there are disgruntled elements within the ranks of the African National Congress, within the ranks of the security forces, who have played a very negative role with regard to the plundering and looting that has taken place in South Africa in recent days. That bespeaks, I'm afraid to say, the factionalism within the highest ranks of the African National Congress. But there is another issue, too, that should be addressed. Given that we are putting so much weight on the misrule, alleged misdeeds of the African National Congress, that raises the question of where's the opposition? And that, too, is a problem, because if you look at the major opposition party, which is the Democratic Alliance, so-called, it's basically a neo-apartheid policy. It basically seeks to defend the interests of the so-called white minority, and therefore does not have much purchase or much of a reputation amongst the African majority. Then you have a group like the so-called economic fighters, which tries to posture itself to the left of the African National Congress. But recall that when Mr. Zuma came into power more than a decade ago, one of the major backers of Mr. Zuma was Julius Malema, who then went on to lead the economic freedom fighters. In fact, he was quoted at the time as saying he would give his life on behalf of Jacob Zuma. And so therefore, the political opposition has not carried the kind of responsibility that it should have, and that only contributes to the crisis.
Okay, Becky in Cape Town seems to be back. Becky, you hear me, right?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, Becky, you know, this military deployment is huge and it's extremely costly and could impose further burden on South African faltering economy. And vigilante groups have been formed to protect infrastructure in their neighborhoods. So what's the right way to restore calm?
You know, there are a couple of issues. For me, one of the options is for the justice system to correct itself. Because if you look at the manner in which the case of former President Zuma was handled, as I said earlier on, it was not handled properly. The judiciary was supposed to have looked at the law, what the law says, but then at the same time consider the possible options in law and then look at the political situation in the country. One of the options they would have taken, for example, would be to say former President Zuma has been found to be in contempt of court, and then he's in the wrong, and therefore we find him guilty. But then in terms of sanctioning He should have just said they are giving him a suspended sentence, not because he has not done anything wrong, but because they are trying to remedy the situation. The second option was, in fact, in my view, okay, a mistake. And on Monday, by the way, there were presentations or submissions by former President Zuma's team trying to plead with the Constitutional Court to reverse its decision, and the judgment has been withheld until further notice. So right now, there is no political solution to this issue, because legally, the president cannot give him pardon unless he has served at least a quarter of his sentence. So the onus now is on the judiciary to rescue the situation without contravening the constitution, and also without breaking the law, because in any case, they will be found to have been in contempt of the law themselves. So for me, that is where I see things going right now.
Okay, now let me turn to Houston and ask Gerald what he thinks is the right way to handle this. Because, you know, Gerald, this has been really unprecedented since a long time ago, like we spoke about. You know, there's vandalism, there is looting and killing. So is this army deployment the right thing to do? Could that restore tranquility or what?
I'm not sure if putting more soldiers on the streets will restore tranquility. Recall that just a few days ago, the president, Mr. Ramaphosa, suggested that there would only be 2,500 soldiers. Mm-hmm. Now there are about 10 times that many. And the unrest continues in KwaZulu-Natal. I think that part of the problem in South Africa, and it's a question that has occurred to me and many friends here in the United States, is that it's rather curious that Mr. Zuma, a post-1994 president, has been jailed. And yet these pre-1994 leaders, of which there are many in South Africa, that is to say those who devised apartheid, those who presided over terror and murder, none of them have been jailed. So I would hope that coming out of this crisis is a decision to go after some of the folks who helped to create this crisis in the first place, speaking of these allies of the United States of America, speaking of these enforcers of apartheid, because we all recognize that one of the reasons why there's so much poverty and inequality in South Africa in the first instance that has driven people into the streets is that it's direct legacy of apartheid. If that is the case, and it certainly is the case, will those who helped to devise apartheid and enforce apartheid have blood on their hands, and they should be punished accordingly?
Okay. Now, Becky, there are some analysts who attribute the situation to factional rivalries inside the ruling African National Congress Party, and that was what Gerald also referred to. Is that the case in your opinion?
No, it is absolutely one of the contributing factors, but not the only factor. Because right now, if you look at the governing party, you look at the NWC, the National Working Committee, it is divided to the core. You look at the National Executive Committee, it is divided to the core. You look at the PEC, the Provincial Executive Committees, in all the 9 provinces, they are divided to the core. And then it goes down to the local branches. So if you have that kind of a situation, it means that whatever action you take will be interpreted along those lines. And in fact, I may add that when the president addressed the nation both on Sunday and on Monday, he didn't help the situation, because he gave the impression that this can be reduced to nothing but ethnic mobilization. That is the concept he used, ethnic mobilization. And I'm one of the people who have subsequently written pieces challenging him on that, saying that if you reduce this important issue to ethnic mobilization, the next thing that will happen, you will have racial problems like we are seeing already right now. So I think there are a couple of problems that need to be attended to, but factionalism in the ANC in fact creates fertile ground for all these other problems to pop up.
Okay. Now, Gerald, there are also some people that are saying that there is evidence that followers of former President Zuma have provoked some of the recent unrest to undermine rivals to return him to power. Is that a possibility?
Well, certainly if you look at the social media feeds of some of Mr. Zuma's family members, not to mention some of his comrades and friends, it would obviously lead you to that conclusion. But I think we need to take a step back and look at the region as a whole. That is to say, it was only a few days ago that neighboring Swaziland, Eswatini as it's now called, was going up in flames. So people were being killed by the security forces because of protests against the last absolute monarchy on the African continent. Zimbabwe, the neighbor to the north, as mentioned, is still reeling from sanctions imposed by the United States, Great Britain, and its allies because of its land reform program. And that has led to a steady drift, a steady migration of people from Zimbabwe into South Africa, which then puts pressure on the social welfare system in South Africa, puts pressure on the system of employment in South Africa as well, contributing to these problems. And then to the east and to the north, you see problems in Mozambique, which is suffering from an insurgency spearheaded by religious zealots who supposedly have ties to the so-called Islamic State. And in fact, there has been talk about South Africa and its neighbors contributing troops to Mozambique, and that too has led to a migration of Mozambicans into South Africa. So you cannot look at South Africa in a vacuum. You have to look at it in the regional context, and when you do, you see that there are many regional problems that are impinging upon the rule of the African National Congress in Pretoria.
Okay. Now, Becky, business confidence has plunged further, especially with this recent looting taking place in South Africa. On top of that, there is unemployment that you mentioned, especially among the youth, complicating the situation. So what's the solution?
At the moment, there is no immediate solution. The first thing that we can do, I was saying to you, as some people in the media houses earlier today, that the first step for me is to eliminate one problem, which sparked this whole thing. That is the issue of the former president. Try to address it within the parameters of the law. Like I was saying, that the judges have withheld the judgment on the appeal that has been made. So that is for me the first step. Because once you eliminate that one, then it means that those who have joined the bandwagon, either as opportunists or as criminals, we will then be in a position to face them because you will have eliminated the main causal factor. So that is the first step. Then, of course, the other one will be for the government to try as much as possible to make sense of the situation and then bring together the international community, more especially international businesses and local businesses, and explain to them, give them confidence as to how they are handling the situation. Because the longer this turmoil takes, the more difficult it will be for the country to recover economically, given the fact that even before the pandemic, the country's economy was already not doing well. With or without the former president, the economy was just going down.
Now, Gerald, what's your prediction? What's going to happen next in the coming days? Will we see calm or will we see an escalation? We have 1 minute.
It's difficult to make a prediction, but I have to say I'm quite worried about the trend that's taking place in South Africa. You might have seen the statement put out by former President Thabo Mbeki, where he basically made the allegation that the entire post-1994 democratic process may be in jeopardy because of what's going on. Certainly, the ongoing unrest in KwaZulu-Natal does not inspire confidence. However, I think that it's important for the South African authorities to redouble their efforts to redistribute the wealth, and particularly to redistribute the wealth on racial grounds, because that's the only way to address the toxic and poisonous legacy of apartheid.
Okay, on that note, we come to the end of this edition of the Spotlight. Let me thank our guest, Wet Fu, Professor of Political Science and Deputy Dean of Research with the University of Western Cape, author of Politics and Higher Education in East Africa from 1920s to 1970s, Becky M. Gomezulo in Cape Town, an endowed chair of history and African American studies, author of White Supremacy Confronted, Gerald Horn in Houston with their contribution. I've been your host, Fahruz Najatini. I'll see you next time.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
In the limelight.
According to If Americans Knew, the U.S. supports Israel with $10.5 million in military aid every day. That is despite the growing economic despair in the United States and having a dilapidated infrastructure. We now present you an article written by Mazia Hashemi, a Tehran-based American journalist, political analyst, and newscaster, and a Press TV journalist. The piece is titled, Is Israel Worth It? Revolutionary is defined as involving or causing a complete and dramatic change. On 11th of February 1979, Iran started the process with the victory of the Islamic Revolution, and that would cause a dramatic change in Iran, as well as the region and the wider world. On 19th of February 1979, the first Palestinian embassy in the world opened in Tehran. Just over 1 week after its own revolutionary victory, Iran not only talked about its support for the Palestinians, but acted upon it. The Israeli embassy was closed down and the Palestinian embassy was opened immediately. Even in the middle of a transition of political systems and with so much pressure on this newly post-revolutionary country, the Palestinians were remembered by the Iranian leadership and told that they had Tehran's support. What a message is sent around the world. However, Tehran had entered a realm that no one or no establishment is allowed to go without paying a price, and that is going against the Zionist regime. But when countries support Israel, they pay an even higher price, and that is the loss of their sovereignty. Just ask the American people about this and the cost they have had to pay for supporting Tel Aviv. According to If Americans Knew, the U.S. supports Israel with $10.5 million in military aid every day. That is despite the growing economic despair in the United States and having a dilapidated infrastructure. After an increasing popularity of the Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions Movement, or BDS movement globally, to put pressure on the Zionist regime, at least for its illegal settlement activities, that according to the United Nations are illegal, 27 states in the United States made it illegal to boycott Israel. It means more than 250 million Americans living in those states, or 78% of the population of the United States, do not have the right to even promote the idea of not buying products from Israel. This is according to Human Rights Watch. And American academics know very well that they can criticize their own country easier than they're allowed to criticize Israel. The red lines have been defined and reinforced with the firing or denial of tenure of professors who dare to criticize the Tel Aviv regime. Just ask Professor Stephen Salater, who was denied a tenured position that he had been offered, and even he had been given up his previous tenured position, and he and his wife were in the process of moving to the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. However, in the interim, Stephen Salita made the fatal mistake of criticizing the Israeli regime in a couple of tweets during the summer of 2014, while Israel was involved in a brutal bombing campaign of the Gaza Strip. He tweeted, "Only Israel can murder around 300 children in the span of a few weeks and insist that it is the victim." And in another tweet, Stephen Salita wrote, "If Netanyahu appeared on television with a necklace made from the teeth of Palestinian children, would anybody be surprised?" Shortly afterwards, he was informed that the offer for him to join the staff of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign would be rescinded. Then there is the case of Professor Norman Finkelstein, who is a renowned political science professor as well as extreme critic of the Israeli regime. After his lectures and writings criticizing the Zionist regime, Finkelstein was denied tenure at DePaul University. This took place in 2007, and since then he has been unable to get a job at any university or even a high school, for that matter, in the United States. And then we have the pressure on journalists to acquiesce to Israel's sovereignty in the United States. There is the case of Helen Thomas, who served 57 years as a White House correspondent and was recorded by a rabbi in an interview saying Israelis should go back to their countries like Germany, Poland, the United Kingdom, wherever they came from. She was forced to resign after being a correspondent for almost six decades. Then there is a case of CNN contributor and academic Mark Lamont Hill. He was speaking at a United Nations session. He called for countries to boycott and divest from the occupied Palestinian territories in conjunction with the United Nations International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people. Mark Lamont Hill said, "We have an opportunity to not just offer solidarity in words, but to commit to political action, grassroots action, local action and international action that will give us what justice requires, and that is a free Palestine from the river to the sea." He was immediately fired from CNN. He had crossed the red line. He could have criticized American policy, but he had chosen to criticize Israeli policy, and that would not be tolerated. That makes one think that Israel is more of a priority in the United States than Americans and the US itself. And if we look at some of America's political representatives, that certainly seems to be the case. Whether we start years ago, when Israel attacked a U.S. naval vessel, the USS Liberty, in 1967, or we look at the present, we see that American politicians have been compromised. Back in 1967, when Lyndon Johnson was president, the Israelis attacked an American ship on purpose. Survivors of the ship have testified to this, as they were attacked more than once by the Israeli Air Force, even after identifying the ship as American. More than 800 rounds of artillery were fired at the ship. When word reached the Americans in the region that the Liberty was under attack, the U.S. carrier Saratoga was deployed along with 12 fighter jets. However, Washington ordered them to turn around and to stand down. Some 34 crew members of the Liberty were killed, and 174 crew members were wounded. U.S. President at the time, Lyndon Johnson, did not allow a thorough investigation to take place of the incident, and after only 1 week declared that it had been a case of mistaken identity. The U.S. government ordered a media blackout, and crew members of the Liberty were given a gag order and could not talk about what had happened until many years later. 2018, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, while addressing the Israeli-American Council in Florida, said, "If this capital crumbles to the ground, the one thing that would remain is our commitment to our aid and our cooperation with Israel." This definitely sounds like confused allegiance at best. And of course, she's not alone, and the majority of politicians in Washington show their commitment to Israel, or they're not likely to get re-elected. And even if we look at the judicial and intelligence realms in the United States, we see that those areas have also been compromised in favor of the Zionist regime. There's the case of American intelligence contractor Jonathan Pollard, who spied for Israel and gave Tel Aviv sensitive information about the United States. Pollard was given a life sentence for espionage, which U.S. defense and intelligence experts said had caused a lot of damage. However, after serving 30 years, he was released at the end of 2020. And he and his wife moved permanently to the occupied Palestinian territories. He was given a hero's welcome upon arrival in the occupied Palestinian lands. Does this not say that in the United States, Israel takes precedence over Americans? And finally, even during this COVID-19 pandemic, which has left the United States struggling, the administration passed the first stimulus package, allegedly designed to help Americans, and $600 per person were allotted. In the same package, $500 million were earmarked for Israel, which according to Tel Aviv has a population of just 9 million. You do the math on this one. The question some Americans are asking is why? Why does it seem that Israel has pervaded all aspects of American society? Why is Israel more important than Americans themselves? And how much longer will Americans tolerate playing second fiddle in their own country? Those who are in the camp of the resistance pay a price for standing up against Israel, but those who support Tel Aviv pay a much higher price. Perhaps Americans will realize what a liability Israel is for them, and they too can decide to make a complete and revolutionary change to their system and become a sovereign nation.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.